Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Coming up on Tech Nation, aren't we all a little disabled in some way? Our concept of disability and how technology can help or not help comes into focus with Virginia Tech professor Ashley Hsu. She wants us to reconsider this in her book, Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. Then in biotech, a new biotech unwittingly makes a mistake with its clinical trial data and shuts its doors. Then what? Dr. Ari Ashir, the CEO of Nuvivo, tells us about the regenesis of its promising ALS drug. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
In a 2013 TechNation interview, UCLA professor Jared Diamond talked to me about his book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies.
What happened 11,000 years ago was the origins of farming, which meant enormous increase in population, because from a wheat field you get far more food than gathering in the forest. But once you get a large population, you start encountering strangers, you need a government, you can support a government, you need laws, and you have formalized wars rather than chronic wars. So stuff changed beginning 11,000 years ago. But there are plenty of societies that in modern times still do not have centralized government to remind us of what traditional societies were like.
Now, the lives and the goals of humans, you know, before and after, as you read your book, you realize they're not that much different.
They, that's to say, people in traditional society, they have children, they have arguments, they have old people that they have to deal with. There are dangers that they have to be aware of. They have religion. They have languages. They have multiple languages. Yeah, so they have these common human problems, which means that no matter how exotic they seem, maybe we can learn from them.
And let's start with the role of older people, you know, in terms of value within the totality of society. I mean, that certainly has changed.
Yeah, that has changed. The most obvious change in the value of old people is that traditionally, before there was writing, older people were the repositories of information. If you wanted to learn something, you asked an old person. Today, if you want to learn something, you look it up in a book or a newspaper or turn on the radio or you Google it. So that means a big loss in value of old people.
Well, it's interesting as well. I think it's not just the facts. It's what maturity brings you in terms of the consequences of things and the importance of being together and, you know, a whole lot of things that doesn't really come through in the Google facts.
That's true. And I, at age 75, am not going to end that discussion by saying that old people have lost a lot of their value. They've gained in value precisely because the rate of technological change today is so rapid. Yet it's perfectly true that I can't turn on my television set. I have to call my sons to talk me through the wretched 41-button remote. But it's also true that conditions have changed so markedly, but some of those old conditions could come back that, for example, it's only older Americans who know the experience of a World War or a Great Depression. And that's a value that old people have even more today because of the rapid rate of change, which means it's only the old people who have experience of conditions that could come back.
Some characterizations of traditional societies continue through the modern era, and certainly if we take China as an example, here's a society in which the elderly were very well respected and has been a tradition. You point out that's beginning to erode.
My Chinese and Japanese friends tell me that there have been big changes in the last several decades in China and in Japan. I believe it was the case until maybe the 1950s that Chinese had an obligation to care for their older parents, a legal obligation. That's no longer the case. In Japan, my wife has Japanese cousins, so we know a good deal about life in Japan. 50 years ago, the majority of marriages in Japan were arranged, not by the couple, but by the relatives. Now, as in the U.S., people date and they arrange their own marriages, but ironically, in Japan, this shift from an arranged marriage to a negotiate-yourself marriage has coincided with the arrival of electronic media, which means that young Japanese lack the social skills. And my wife's cousin told us of being in a restaurant in Japan where there was a couple obviously there on their first date, and they were very shy, and they were opposite sides of the table. They weren't talking to each other. They were texting each other because they hadn't learned the social skills to talk with each other.
You perhaps know UCLA professor Jared Diamond best as the author of 1997's Guns, Germs, and Steel, or his first book, The Third Chimpanzee. I was able to speak with Professor Diamond about the world until yesterday on TechNation in 2013. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is TechNation. Today on TechNation, rethinking just being human. We all are less able than we used to be, and it only gets more complicated as we live life and ultimately age. Virginia Tech professor Ashley Hsu joins me to talk about Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. Then in biotech, Dr. Ari Ashir, the CEO of Nuvivo. She joins me to talk about the journey of a new ALS drug. And what can happen when you don't check your clinical trials data? This drug also shows potential in Huntington's, Alzheimer's disease, and vascular dementia. Yes, sometimes regenesis is possible.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Professor Hsu. Dr. Hsu, welcome to TechNation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, your book is Against Techno-Ableism, and we can talk about that and being against it, but let's just start with ableism. You write, in its simplest form, ableism is bias or discrimination against people or stigma against the status of disability, a bias toward non-disabled lives and ways of being. What does that mean?
It means we really like to set hierarchies among people, and that in so many facets of life and existence, in ways we don't even fully recognize often, non-disabled people are valued above disabled people. Non-disabled testimony is valued above disabled testimony. People get lumped into like categories of disability when people disbelieve them, right? That you don't trust a person's testimony. Therefore, they are disabled, right? Bad and disabled go together, in these sorts of worlds. So it has to do with sort of like who we trust for information, who we trust to tell us things about themselves and believe it, and who has to monitor others, right? This is set up, you know, sort of, in so many ways, just informally in how people interact with each other, but also in the ways in which, like, we require more documentation for disabled people to be counted as disabled, right? To get accommodations in the workplace and in school. We ask for someone else to certify that, someone else who we trust as an expert. And even when we ask what accommodations are needed, often we look past the disabled person who could probably tell you what they need. But instead we need disability services professionals to say, oh, here are the things, since we have seen this documentation and now we might believe it because it came from someone else. And this is so deeply intersected with other types of bias, that people are also read as less trustworthy, as sketchy. These sorts of things, you know, play into, you know, all sorts of categories of marginalization as well. And often ableism undergirds other types of marginalization because you believe a particular population, race, is somehow less intelligent, less trustworthy. This plays into as a justification for different types of bias against, you know, whatever group is being targeted.
Well, I have to say that in the university teaching arena, if someone has a disability of some sort, as you say, they have to bring in another professional and they have to report it to that center. They have to go through that. And then they have to say, well, given your course, these are the accommodations you must make.
It's like, yeah.
Well, that's great. We already worked it out. And we might do a little more, a little less, or, you know, it's like, you're talking to the person one-on-one, and they're saying, you know, frankly, if I could just go in a quiet place over here, it'd be just fine. It's like, okay, good. And at the same time, you don't want them, or at least I don't want them, to be called out as different. You know, I made one deal where very conscientious student, and it's like, and that person got to, like, sit with the test. And, you know, twice, you know, 50% more. Mm-hmm. It's like, you don't think that the rest of the room is going to notice that?
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, so we made this deal. It's like, here you go. You do as much as you can and we're going to give you 50% more points.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And it was like, deal. She was just charging through everything, but nobody ever knew. Why would you create a situation and someone appears to be different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of barriers related to disability are created ones, right? That we have, I mean, I think about even the emergence of the concept of disability, like, has to do with sort of expectations around work, around, like, what is an expected, like, day long of work. And of course, not everyone can work an unlimited number of hours or stand at a machine. If we talk about what disability starts to mean in, like, the era of industrialization, you know, we might not have considered blind people, amputees, and people who are dyslexic all in the same category until we have sort of standardized ideas about what work should be, right? And there are prior times where work is various and work is in the home and you can take breaks when you want them, you know, that work looks different, you know, up until sort of a modern era, when really we get the, like, why do we all these, like, it's the setup of a joke, right? Like, wow. What do an amputee, a blind person, someone who's dyslexic, someone with bipolar 2, what do all these people have in common? Well, they get counted as disabled, and they get counted as disabled because, like, this, like, when we talk about disability as a social construction, well, it doesn't mean it's not real, right? We can find disability in the fossil record. However, you know, that we count all of these things as disability together and then talk about all of these categories as, like, problematic, things that interfere with your ability to fit into a social environment, an educational environment, a work environment. That's when we really get the concept of disability sort of gelling together in the way we understand it now.
Now, techno-ableism, I almost had it wrong there. Techno-ableism, you say, is a particular strain of ableism. What part is it?
So I study disability narrative, and what I, like, witness again and again is this sort of description of technology as saving us from disability, right? That the reason we should invest in technology is to empower disabled people, that disabled people are somehow calling out for help, even when sometimes we are not, and that, you know, every disabled person is supposed to want some sort of techno solution, is part of this sort of narrative that we see. And, you know, I'm not the only person who's noticing this trend in, like, news and media about technology and disability. I've just put the name to it. There are plenty of other scholars who are talking about this phenomenon in ways that, you know, are rich and interesting with different case studies, but it's such a common thing to see technology described as a solution for disability, but also, like, to justify more expenditures on tech. You know, I see it as, like, a way of, you know, people talk about greenwashing. This is, like, washing over with sort of, oh, you're concerned about disabled people. when some of these projects don't really have disabled people sort of as like an end result. And some of the things are very much in tension with what disabled people actually want. So they're often pursuing like the wrong problems, and not necessarily the ones disabled people might care about when we do have problems. Techno-ableism also paints disabled existence as always problematic, and that abnormalizes disabled people and adds its own level of stigma too.
Especially since life is hard. You die.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, really? I'm it bad and you don't? You don't look so good over there. But not to downplay the challenges of being disabled. One of the most powerful two pages I've read lately was the first two pages of your book. And you alluded to it in just what you were saying. You take apart every popular, preconceived, emotion-choking, applause-inviting storyline that you can find. And I'd love you to give me a few samples that either exemplifies or reinforces this techno-enableism. And I have to say, you use the word crip a lot, both in those two pages in chapter 3 about the media entitled Scripts and Crips. How encompassing is that term, and who can use that term? So I know that's a big question, but let's take it all together.
Yeah, so the term crip is a derivative of the word cripple, which is not language you should use about disabled people any longer. You know, it shows up, you know, historically, and people know what you mean when you say crippled, but it is not a way people would usually describe themselves today, unless if they're doing it in like an ironic punk fashion. So there's a whole movement called Crip Punk. And there's lots of blogs that use the word crip where people are using it for themselves. We might compare it to the word queer as it was used a couple decades ago with the reclaiming. It has now been like fully reclaimed in a way that crip is not yet. I don't suggest like a whole bunch of non-disabled people start calling disabled people crips. And there's also like some worries, for some people with using the word crip that it points to physical disability, but there's actually like in the historical record, people who talk about mental cripples. So I actually think that that's incorrect. This historical record of the use of crip actually covers over like a wide swath of disability in ways that are maybe unexpected today. But yeah, it's a term that's being reclaimed by some and used in fun ways. The Crip Punk movement does it. There's a million blogs. There's claiming crip. There's the bad cripple. There's a couple others that I'm sure I'm missing now. A crippled scholar writes a blog. That's Ash Gray. Tales from the Crip, that's Ingrid Tischer's blog. There's some really great wordplay with the word crip available in these blogs, as you can see. But it's a cheeky, in-your-face approach and sort of labeling yourself before anyone else does, right? Maybe this is the word people are thinking but aren't saying about you, so you're going to put it up there up front. Get over it, that this is not necessarily your encompassing identity, but it's a component of it, and people need to get over it too.
And yet in the media, there are a lot of prescribed storylines that seem to rub you a little wrong. So let's go there.
Yeah. So I have the book, and, you know, I talk about, maybe I could tell you a story about my monstrous birth. This is a real term used about people with congenital differences when they are born in the historical record. And, I fight against the odds after my monstrous birth, and now you can almost respect me. You know, I become disabled in a freak accident, and I overcome sort of the weird circumstances around me. Or, if I'm not born and it's not an accident, I acquire some disability and I suffer so. You might tell stories about how I've been so brave in the face of my suffering. We hear these, people want these stories from us, which is to say, you know, I can be out in public doing very little and be told by people, oh, you're such an inspiration, or what's your story, or what, worse yet, what happened to you? Right. Asking, for an explanation about my body, or, you know, for other people with apparent disabilities, about their body or about their movements or about their speech, needing a story to make sense of the person's existence. So that's some of what's going on in the early part of this book, my book.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Ashley Hsu. She's a professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech and co-founder of DiscoTech. That's the Disability Community Technology Center at Virginia Tech. She's here today with Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. Now, you have an unusual experience in that you were able for a part of your life and then disabled. The pivotal point came when you were 30, I believe. You were an adult. You had a husband and two children. So you've had both experiences.
Yeah. And when I was non-disabled, I imagined my life as a non-disabled person in the future. I think so often when we talk about disability, people focus on very young people. So there's lots of talk about particularly education in K-12 and disability and about like pediatric therapies and things like that. And there's a whole lot of investment and thought about, you know, aging and sort of acquired disability as a person ages. There's not a lot of thought about the middle part of most of our lives, where lots of people do acquire disability in various ways in the middle of their lives. But we don't hear these stories as often, unless if there's some sort of dramatic tale about military work. But outside of that, we really don't see these stories, but they're very, very common, right? So my experience isn't uncommon. It's just not represented very often where people acquire, you know, a variety of disabilities. Most of us are multiply disabled. I want to say that too. Like so much research, when they recruit you as like a human subject, they want you to have one disability and nothing else. And that means that most research that's done about disability is not really done about most disabled people, right? That's even a narrower sliver than anyone, you know, anyone thinks about, because most people, when they acquire a disability, acquire more than one. And if you have a disability earlier in your life, you're more likely to acquire more disabilities at earlier points in your life, than other people do. You know, some of those can be, you know, mental health disabilities, where, you know, constant ableism might lead you to different, you know, PTSD and that kind of thing, the sort of things you're encountering as a person with a mental health disability. You know, I think about the ways in which, you know, and Margaret Price and Ellen Samuels and Sammy Schock write about this, the way our bodies and minds are deeply like connected to each other. Like it's one thing. This is called body minds in disability studies, that we that what's going on physically and what's going on mentally are not separate, right? And people with mental health disabilities experience physical symptoms like pain and fatigue. And people with physical disabilities also have sort of cognitive effects of some of those things too. So, you know, it's hard to even talk in a limited way about disability. And certainly my acquisition involved like a number of categories at once.
Would you mind telling us about what happened to you?
Oh yeah, no,
it could happen to anybody.
Well, it could. I was 30, so of course I had the bones of a 16-year-old, and I got a pediatric bone cancer called osteosarcoma. And I felt very out of time in that as well. That most people with this particular type of cancer are children. So I went through a pretty grueling year of chemotherapy. I received an amputation, to my left leg, rotationplasty style amputation, which I really like. And then I'm infertile. My ovaries stopped working thanks to chemotherapy. I have tinnitus and hearing loss from cisplatin chemotherapy. I almost forgot that I have chemo brain, which makes sense if you have chemo brain and you're a little bit forgetful. I mean, it works because I'm a professor, and sort of like an absent-minded professor is its own trope. So in fact, I don't often have to mention the chemo brain, but in fact, I can forget meetings and get lost in time. And I don't have, like, I can remember being able to wake up and know what day it was. That hasn't happened since my chemotherapy. So there are some like noticeable differences in function, even when it comes to sort of cognitive behavior, in my own life. So yeah, I have a number of categories represented. I love participating in cross disability groups. And that's part of like, that's reflected, I hope, in the book, that I'm really interested in talking about us together. Right. As someone, particularly with multiple disabilities, I learn from other disabled people every day. I half the hacks I use for my daily existence are from my friends with ADHD, because my chemo brain like looks a little bit like that sometimes. So I'm able to set alarms on my phone, thanks to my friends who said, hey, you know, you're missing a lot of meetings. Here's what you do. Here's the skill that I'm going to teach you. And I know this exists for other types of disability too, where we're trying out each other's devices. You know, someone has a new pair of crutches and we're all taking a spin. You know, where we're showing off things we really like. I mean, I love it when wheelchair users talk about using barbecue tongs for things. Like that is, you learn that from your disabled friends. That these are things that we find useful that we share and aren't necessarily like commercializable. You know, I'm just using the basic app that lets me set alarms that everyone has programmed into their phone. Like it's not a disability technology, but every day I'm using it as a disability technology.
Now, much of the technology is actually designed and built by non-disabled people. That's problematic.
Well, it is. And I think a lot of times, I think we have a lot of technological failure because of this. So we hear hyped in the news, oh, this university team creates this new thing. A lot of that won't ever make it to market. Most non-disabled people don't understand the circumstances of our lives, how they're controlled by sort of gatekeeping doctors and therapists, how they're controlled by our insurance system, even what doctors I can see, what technologies I would be offered. A lot of these things are very much controlled by a system that those happy engineering teams that are showing you off their equipment, even if they could get them to market, wouldn't be useful, wouldn't be purchasable by most disabled people. Not to mention that a lot of us worry a lot more about maintenance. So this is a major theme that I think about quite often, like the amount of time I spend just maintaining the devices I have, right? Putting new batteries or in my hearing aids, which is every week, or cleaning out, taking apart the hearing aids, cleaning them out in different ways to make sure they still function. Like I'm doing pretty routine work on some of my equipment. When it comes to my leg, if I bust a piece of my leg, I have to get an appointment with my prosthetist. He lives 4 hours away. Like my whole week is going to just change immediately. If I mess something up with my leg, unless if it's something that I can call him and he can talk it and I can sit in the hardware store and he can tell me how to fix it until next week. If it's something like that's not big, and that's happened multiple times now. That's only because my prosthetist like lets me call him on his cell phone, and not everyone has that sort of access either. You know, for wheelchair repairs in the United States, it can be weeks or months for pretty basic fixes because of the way different repair shops have been merged and bought out by a conglomerate that has slowed everything down. So what you, as a wheelchair user, you need to make friends with your local bike shop if you're going to need any quick fix on something. It is not ideal.
I'm speaking with Virginia Tech's Dr. Ashley Hsu. She's here today with Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. We'll talk more after a break. Whole Tech Nation programs or solely biotech-only interviews are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com or biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, looking more closely at past clinical trial data. Is the analysis right? And then, can we go back and get even more data from our original clinical trial subjects? Data that could give a whole new view into the success of your drug. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Virginia Tech professor Dr. Ashley Hsu about techno-ableism. She suggests perhaps we should rethink who needs improvement.
So many things are created without thinking about their longevity in use. This happens like there are people who received, what was it, second sight retinal implants, and the manufacturer went out of business and their implants turned off. It's something literally implanted in your eyes and now it doesn't work. What do you do? And this is a whole ongoing thing for people who received the second sight devices. For cochlear implants, there have been cases that made the news in the past year where a particular type of cochlear implant that was like made for the developing world, an Indian government program paid for a whole bunch of them. And now the company that made them won't be servicing them. And you won't be able to use it or hear anymore. And it is literally implanted in your head. Like I think people often forget the ways we're made vulnerable even when we cooperate with the technological systems that exist.
Now, there is that which is visible and that which is not easily observable. And you talk about neurodiversity. Let's go there.
Yeah. So, I mean, because I have chemo brain, I am in this umbrella category that is created by autistic people and people with ADHD. So there's this term called neurodivergent and sort of the neurodiversity movement. And it starts with the observation, right? Neurodiversity is just not all of us think alike. We have brains that work differently. And the movement takes this observation and goes, and that should be okay. Right. Instead of always trying to get people to conform to a particular type of thinking, which isn't going to happen for a lot of people, or to like meet some sort of arbitrary standard of like how we might define intelligence or like the speed of thought or something along those lines, or even like our understanding of time and being plugged into that in a particular way. So there's this huge umbrella called neurodiversity. And I love that, you know, even though it was created, you know, largely by autistic people and people with ADHD, it is meant to encompass so much more than that. So people with mental health disabilities also count as neurodivergent. Their brains work differently. You know, people with traumatic brain injuries, it doesn't have to be like something you start out your life with to be part of this huge umbrella. And I really like that because, in fact, people with traumatic brain injuries, people with chemo brain, people with CP.
And CP is?
Oh, cerebral palsy, which is deprivation of oxygen at or before, slightly before birth, and can cause, for a lot of people, a lot of physical symptoms that people recognize. But also, everyone with CP is also neurodivergent, right? That is something that has affected your brain, and it affects how your brain sends signals to the rest of your body. So it's a huge category. But one thing I like is that we can actually like learn from each other. And that's part of being part of this umbrella category. Like my life hacks are coming from people with ADHD, right? I'm very plugged into what they're saying. I find what my friends with autism are saying really interesting. Their life hacks do not work for me in the same sort of way, but I'm learning to like respect that that's how they work. So sort of having ongoing conversations about what works best or things to try, the things we learn from each other. Some of them are technological, you know, how to use which technologies to, you know, do what you want to do. But some of them are like getting the appropriate accommodations. It's not like you have one disability and then this should be your accommodation, that like this equals this, because disabilities affect people in different ways. So we can actually learn like what accommodations might be useful for us. Like when I think about my autistic friends who use the noise canceling headphones, you know, to be able to go grocery shop. That's a great thing that you can share that might work for you. So it gives you things to try out without, you know, necessarily the same commitment of investing in a medical system that may not even know this and undermines your existence to begin with, right? Like that push to normalize, yeah.
And it certainly addresses that whole idea of you were just looking for one good technology and everything will be fine.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, so much techno-solutionism is also built around, here's the disability, here's our solution for it. But it also like fails to really understand us, not just as multiply disabled people, but when we talk about things like exoskeletons, one of the ways in which a lot of paralyzed users talk about those is that isn't like walking isn't the problem. Like walking isn't at like the top of the list of problems they might want addressed. In fact, things like more research on bowel and bladder health, more infrastructure investments so that using a wheelchair isn't a subpar option, right? If we build a better infrastructure, in fact, using a wheelchair could be just as valid of an option. It's only in the face of infrastructure that has been built to exclude that wheelchairs seem like a poorer option than walking. You can't divorce it, of course, from this larger social context. And the people who think exoskeletons are going to solve, and I put that in scare quotes, the problem, another scare quotes, of wheelchair use. It's all the problem of wheelchairs, like fail to see like wheelchairs as a liberatory device that take people places they want to go. And also like, a lot of wheelchair users aren't paralyzed. There are lots of wheelchair users that can stand up and are in them for different reasons. So people who have seizure disorders, who like falling down repeatedly is probably not a great idea. Or people who, have things like POTS, where if you stand up too quickly, you might pass out and fall down, or your heart rate gets elevated in a bad way. There are many uses for wheelchair use. So it also like, it fails to see like, disabilities in a fine-grained way, but also fails to like understand what the users they're thinking about to begin with, like what they would actually care about, which you could get by asking them. But a lot of people imagine these projects without asking disabled people what they take as a problem.
Well, we're going to have to skip some of the book because I really want to get to talk about the future. You write, the future is disabled for each individual, and more expansively, the future is disabled with humanity writ large, and it goes on to the planet, to changing weather patterns and natural disasters through emerging and new diseases. When we start to look at this, it paints a whole different picture. If you are human, you are disabled in many different ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why it's so sad that we don't do better planning for disability. So many technological like visions of the future, when they're not dystopian, are visions where disability is a problem that has already been solved. A lot of our science fiction, you know, if disabled characters even show up, there's some device attached to them where they can see just as good or even better, if we're talking like Geordi LaForge or something like that, or even better than the people around him can see. Often disabled people are considered like test pilots for the future. Like, oh, we're going to get these technologies. We'll work them out on disabled people. And then in the future, everyone's going to want these sorts of implants. And, you know, just given the amount of time I spend like fussing with my hearing aids, like I'm pretty sure like implanting a whole bunch of things that I don't need inside of me isn't as good of an idea as they seem to think it is. And it imagines a world in which disabled people no longer exist, right? And you stop seeing disabled people as a category of people that is a community, because the future has, you know, technology has come along. It's a story of triumph of technology, and the goal is no disabled people. And I think that's not true. Just like from basic, like, hey, we have a whole bunch of newly disabled people from COVID. And some of them are just realizing they're disabled with long COVID. We're going to see a sort of a long trail of disability. I think about it. I think about polio, right? This was a mass disabling event, and, you know, it played out over the next few decades, in terms of, sort of disability community organizing and people with post polio syndrome, like recognizing themselves as disabled and participating in community in different ways and in ways that I thought were really revolutionary and radical. That's the nice part about it. But there's a sense in which, like, our climate, we are changing it, and, you know, even if we were able to control things like COVID, we have new places that get ticks now, and sort of Lyme disease and tick-borne diseases are, you know, expanding their sort of reach geographically. We can imagine all sorts of ways in which climate change, not just the natural disasters caused by climate change, which we will see disability from the natural disasters caused by climate change, but sort of the health disasters, long-term health, chronic conditions. We already have like more people with asthma. That's going to increase. Different like nutrition and food will change, right? If we talk about like vitamin deficiencies and people's land changing due to climate change, there's sort of like an infinite number of possibilities in my head of like how the future is definitely disabled.
Yes.
Just in a practical way. We should be planning for disability. It's a pressing case, and making the world one that's more habitable for all disabled people is really important if our futures are disabled, and I think they almost surely are.
Well, Dr. Hsu, I want to thank you for joining me, and I hope you'll come back and see us again.
I would love to. Thank you so much.
My guest today is Dr. Ashley Hsu. She's a professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech and co-founder of DiscoTech. That's the Disability Community Technology Center at Virginia Tech. You can find that on the web at discotech.org. That's DiscoTech.org. More of her writing and many resources are available at her website, techanddisability.com. Her book, which we've been discussing at length in this interview, is Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. It's published by W.W. Norton. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. This is the biotech equivalent of an old story, the one which starts with a guy walks into a bar. However, this being the biotech equivalent, it goes something like this. A promising new biotech with a very new approach gets significant funding. Its drug fails after two phase two trials, and they shut their doors. It's unfortunate. It's expensive, but it happens. And then what? Normally, nothing. Unless the original founder scientists just don't believe that the drug could fail. Dr. Ari Ashir is the founder and CEO of Nuvivo. She tells us about the regenesis of this promising ALS drug, how it was reacquired, how they figured out what the problem was, how they went back and got even more data from the same patients, and about its new drug application recently submitted to the FDA. Additionally exciting, this drug has other potential. Nuvivo is ready to initiate phase two studies in Huntington's, Alzheimer's disease, and vascular dementia. Dr. Ashir, welcome.
Glad to be here, Moira.
Now, we're going to be talking about a lot today. Yes, there are medical conditions that Nuvivo is working on and has had some success in, such as ALS, Huntington's, muscular dystrophy, frontotemporal dementia, and more. But we're also talking about how biotech companies can take a, well, we'll call it perhaps a misstep or a missing of the opportunity. And this is one for the books, I must say. Let's start with Nuvivo's lead compound, NP001. And there already is a good story there. Those of you in biotech know that a company develops a number of drug candidates, all somewhat different, and they're numbered from one to however many drug compounds they're working on. Normally, a company's very first drug that they would take into human trials might be number 610 or number 302 if they were just a startup and had just working on variations on their one drug. But this is the very first time that I've seen it. Nuvivo's first drug in clinic is number one. And why? Because you, Dr. Ashir, started Nuvivo by purchasing this drug from another company where it had failed in human trials. And you purchased the drug and all its human data and all its intellectual property because you knew the drug. How did you know the drug?
Well, I know this drug because I actually started a company called Neuraltos, and this was the drug that I was one of the founders and have the patent holder, and I developed it in Neuraltos. So we took it up to phase one and phase two human clinical trial, and it was very exciting data, and the company decided they wanted to have somebody from Big Pharma running the company after me. I was a CEO and a founder of the company at that time, and then I left.
Aha. So we needed somebody from the big pharmaceutical area, and you had to exit. So no longer with the company.
Yes.
How long ago was that?
I left in 2011.
So that's 13 years ago. Very exciting. Very exciting. Now, by my count, they went through five CEOs. in the meantime before you purchase the drug. And we'll return to that story. So listener, put a pin in it. But now we're going to talk about ALS as the drug was developed to treat ALS. So describe what ALS is like for people with the condition. What is it?
ALS is neurodegenerative disease. That means gradually within 2 to 4 years after diagnosis, the patient die. It can start from top, you know, from the speech pattern, gradually different muscles lose function and so on. So it's a very hard disease and the duration is very short.
I understand that it's very difficult to diagnose.
Well, because, as I told you, it starts from different parts of the body. And the diagnosis at the moment, I think, is still a challenge for people. So people come and they have sort of hand tremble. So they don't know whether it's ALS or it's something else. And they have a speech problem. They don't know whether it's ALS or something else. And they have to go to neurologists to be able to diagnose. They start with normally, you know, general practitioner, and then they will go to neurologist.
How many people have ALS? How is this very widespread?
No, it's an orphan drug. There is a more, at the moment they say there's 30,000 people. And 30,000 people, I think there's a lot of people who are misdiagnosed. The problem is more than that. The first time it was diagnosed was Lou Gehrig 80 years ago. And since then, there has never been any therapy for treatment of ALS.
So if you're diagnosed with it, and there sure it is, then within several years, you just can't expect to recover.
Yes, within 2 to 4 years, you probably die, unfortunately.
And the drug that we're talking about, was it a pill, an injection? How would the patients take it?
Oh, it's an injection. They take it the first month. They take 5 days in a row. And then after that, three treatments a month for 6 months. That was the study that we have conducted.
Now, how is this drug different from other approaches to treating ALS?
Oh, this is wonderful, because I think everybody else has tried to figure out what is missing, which neuron is damaged, and try to figure out the healing that neuron. Our approach is very different. We think ALS starts in immune system. So if we can regulate immune system, we can stop any attack, and the body can automatically recover from any attack it takes, whether it's a neuro damage, whether it's extra proteins, whether it is viruses or bacteria infection. If we can regulate the immune system, it recovers from all these attacks.
Now, what exactly is wrong with the immune system in the case of ALS?
There is, because it's been attacked very intensely, it is missing a molecule which normally uses for recovery of the immune system. This molecule is called toric chloramine. So we provide this molecule so the system can recover, has the ability to recover.
So you're not in the brain. You're in the immune system treating ALS.
Yes, correct.
So let me get this straight. That company took this drug through phase 1, phase 2A, 2B, you know, two trials there in phase 2, and it's a failure. It doesn't work, right?
Yes, but we didn't believe it.
So along with the drug trial failure, the company failed, and usually that's that. But you acquired it. And now you could really take a look at the protocols of the trials, at the data that had been collected and had been looked at, you know, which had determined that the drug had failed. Some 200,000 pages of paper, which is just shocking to anyone. What did you learn when you looked at all this?
So what we learned first, we were surprised, because usually when you do another trial, you repeat what you find the first time. So they didn't do that. So we start looking at the data very extensively from all direction. We found that there was a programming mistake. So we fixed that. And then we start looking at the data to understand how our molecule works. So we have looked at many different ways of understanding the way that the molecule works. And also in this process, we were lucky because the science has also came up and we have some other supporting other scientists telling us our way of looking at the immune system is the right way. So we looked at the molecule, we understood it, and it impacts the ability to breathe. The reason these people die is because we stop, they have a breathing problem. And so we said, oh my God, the ability to breathe. And then we understood why does it, the ability of breathe, where does it impact? It was a diaphragm, so it's a muscle impact. So we decided to look at other muscle functions in the body. You know, we added both trials together. There were two phase two trials. We added together and we looked at the impact on functionality of how different muscles and function impacted in ALS, like the ability to talk, the ability to eat, the ability to walk, the ability to breathe, the ability to putting a jacket on. So we looked at every single muscle function and we saw that it improves. The totality of the data shows it significantly impacts four people, mainly 65 years and younger. The reason is, like, you know, like anything, after 65 years old, you know, our muscle deteriorates, our skin is has not as good as when we were younger. Also, immune system declines. So these people, 65 youngers, their immune system was still able to engage, to be able to get the molecule NP001 and recover from any attack that the body has been under.
So here you are. You've got all this data from phase 2A and phase 2B, the two phase 2 trials, and you've reprogrammed it so you get the true results here, showing very positive results. And let's not forget that this is an orphan drug. So you don't need to do a big phase 3 trial. If this had been successful the first time out in phase 2A and B, you would go right to a new drug application, an NDA, to say, great, we're ready to go to a new drug, applying to the FDA. And so what do you do then? You've got this positive data. What do you do then?
That's a really good question. So we thought, okay, we have an impact on respiratory function. So we need to know whether it's a survival benefit. So we had the patients, but we hadn't collected how long did they live after they took the treatment. So we hired this contract research organization. They went back to all the clinical investigators who had enrolled this patient and in a blinded fashion. So we didn't know who was on a drug and who was on a placebo. And they collected the last date that these patients were alive. This was 11 years of tracking every single patient. And then we did the survival study, which was statistically significant for patients under 65 years old. So we got obviously very excited. And now we decided to put the new drug application. So for the entire population, the extension of survival was four months. There is nothing in the pipeline that any treatment extends the survival more than 2 and 3 months. Then we looked at 65 years and younger, and in that patient population, the extension of survival was 17.1 months, which is unheard of after 6 months of treatment. Just after 6 months of treatment. So we thought, okay, now we have a drug. So we decided to put a new drug application package together. And we took us like 6 months to put the package together. As Moira said, it took 200,000 pages. And we submitted to FDA about 6 weeks ago. And we are hoping to get approval in summer or spring next year.
This is very exciting. Now, obviously, this will help somewhat people over 65, but under 65, this is phenomenal news. You know, a year and a half more, just with 6 months of treatment. Now, the question that I have is, like, why wasn't it any better for people over 65?
Well, the people over 65, their immune system has declined, so they are not necessarily able to engage in recovery. So it is too much further down because of other diseases. Some people have diabetes, some people have cancer, some people have cardiovascular. So the inflammation is far more than just ALS inflammation.
Now, I know you're also working on other medical conditions, Huntington's, muscular dystrophy, frontotemporal dementia, and others. Is it the same drug you are using?
Yes, we are hoping to use the same drug, and might be different formulation. So the orphan drug like Huntington, we think with one study, we can actually apply for new drug application for that disease as well. But for bigger drugs, you know, an indication like Alzheimer, Parkinson, that might be different. We might need to do two studies.
But as we said earlier, this is a whole new approach. You're not looking at the neurons and the neurological part to treat. You're backing it up to the immune system and the missing molecule that is the recovery molecule.
Yes. That's why it's so exciting, because we're getting the body to act as a healthy body that they can recover by themselves. And that's really what is so exciting about our findings.
Well, yours is an exceptional journey. What would you say to entrepreneurs out there, biotech and otherwise?
I would say, first of all, more important, you need to understand your data. And your data can be understood by scientists, medical profession, who knows the science behind the drug, and also the disease, how the disease works. So you really need to look at every single data point that you have. And, you know, we call it in our profession biomarkers. Like, how do we know the muscle is improving? When you go to clinical labs, there is something that's called creatine. They measure it. And that tells you that your muscle is working, your kidney is working. Very simple. You don't really need to do much. And we had this data. We just needed to analyze.
Well, I think that the lesson is, if Dr. Ashir is looking to buy a company, stand next to her and buy some of it too.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Ashir, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll come back and see us again.
Thank you, Mira. It was a pleasure. And I love to share my experience so other people can learn from it and not give up so soon.
Dr. Ari Ashir is the founder and CEO of NuVivo. More information is available on the web at NuVivo.com. That's NuVivo, NuVivo.com. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.
News from the BBC is next. Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car to KQED is easy. We'll arrange to have it picked up, running or not in most cases, and invest the funds back into our news coverage. Learn more at kqed.org/cars. A donor-advised fund is one of the most tax-efficient ways to give. Maximize your charitable impact by recommending a grant to KQED to support the public media you and your community rely on. Learn more at kqed.org/DAF. And thank you.